All right, I need you guys to step up your game a little bit. If you noticed, Roman got some applause for his prayer. I don't remember the last time I got applause for teaching a class or for doing a prayer. I'm not saying. I'm feeling a little deprived. So I don't see Casey. She's probably teaching in class. I don't know what has got into Roman, but I love it because Roman is constantly bugging me. You got a spot for me? You got a spot for me? And so tonight he's like, "Can I do a prayer? Can I do something?" And I said, "Well, brother," I said, "all the slots are kind of full." I said, "We're getting a new one for November." I said, "I'm gonna find my name down on all of them." So I admire that because I was well into my 30s before I did any of that kind of stuff, and I was jealous of the youngsters like Roman and the young ones who kind of get started on that, doing that early, because I don't know if, anyway, how nice it would have been if I'd gotten over those jitters at 6 or 7 or 8 years old instead of 40 or 50 or 60 years old. Yeah. So I was invited to speak to the ladies' class today and thrilled to do that and loved it and was very honored by the request, but my palms were sweaty. I was nervous. You ladies scared me to death. I was terrified. But I enjoyed it very much. So I'm not sure if I'd started with Roman at Roman's age, if I'd gotten over my fear or not. Maybe I'd still be afraid. But I love the fact that there's young people who are eager. You know, give me a job. Give me something to do. Let me serve. All right, we are in 1 Timothy chapter 2. I thought it was interesting. I was doing a little research. So we have Paul's letters to the church, to Timothy, 1 and 2 Timothy. He's ministering in Ephesus. We have the letter that Paul wrote to the church in Ephesus. We have the church in Ephesus mentioned in Revelation chapter 2, and as Jesus dictates his notes to the churches through John. And it's kind of interesting because Ephesus, the letter, Ephesians, is somewhat unique in the fact that Paul doesn't deal with any heresies. There doesn't seem to be any great controversies in the church. It seems basically that the letter of the church in Ephesus is about expanding their faith and deepening their faith and broadening their understanding of the blessings they have in Christ. So it's really a very encouraging, positive letter. But there's no heresies that are dealt with. You know, Corinthians, that's just all it is. Okay, we need to fix this. We need to work on this. We need to approve that. We need to change this. But the letter to the church in Ephesus is kind of like, hey, let's talk about the blessings we have in Christ. And the letter that Jesus dictates in Revelation chapter 2, I kind of think that was written, I think, around 90. 1 Timothy was probably written in the early middle 60s. The letter to the church in Ephesus was written probably right around 60. So by the time we get into the mid-60s and he writes to Timothy, there's some issues to deal with. By the time John writes in 90 AD, by the time John records Jesus' notes to the church in Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2, around 90, Jesus says, I know your deeds, and I know you can't stand false teachings. And the teachings of the Nicolaitans, I think he says. So he praises the church in Ephesus for their ability to detect and to put a stop to false teaching, which is kind of interesting because that's one of the first things Paul tells Timothy, right? Chapter 1, there's some teaching around here you got to take care of. And there's myths and genealogies and some of this nonsense that people are focusing on. There's some people that are giving too much attention to the Old Testament and trying to put it in a position of authority over the New Testament church. So one of the first things Paul tells Timothy, when you get there, you need to deal with this. And by the time Jesus dictates his letter to John in Rome in Revelation chapter 2, the church is remembered for that. You know, you guys have figured out how to tell false teaching, and you don't tolerate it. You don't deal with that. But he goes on in Revelation chapter 2 to say, while you guys, the good thing is you guys don't tolerate false teaching. You can recognize it. You can do away with it. Whichever. So Timothy must have done a good job. The bad thing is you've lost your first love. And I think What he's saying there is that they've gotten so good at detecting false teaching that they've lost some grace. They've lost some grace and patience for learners and for people that are kind of on the steep curve, learning curve, where they're trying to figure out where the center of God's will is. And hopefully all of us are trying to figure that out. So it's kind of interesting that the letter written around 60 doesn't have any heresies to deal with. Paul's letters to Timothy in the early to mid-60s, we've got some problems. By the time we get to the 90s that Jesus dictates his letters, like Jesus says, I got a problem with you guys. You know, you figured out the false teaching thing, but you lost some love here. So the church in Ephesus had some trouble by the time Timothy got there that needed to be dealt with. According to chapter 1, there were some people there, chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, there were some men there who loved controversies, myths and genealogies. They've spent too much time on that. According to 2 Timothy chapter 2, there were some people in the church that denied the future resurrection. I don't know how you preach it. This world is all we've got, and preach it in a manner that's uplifting and encouraging. But there were some, by the time we get to 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 17 and 18, they said, you know, there's no resurrection. What you're enjoying now is the resurrected life. 2 Timothy chapter 3, there were some people that took advantage of some gullible women. Some of the women were spending their time gossiping rather than using their energy on more beneficial pursuits. That's chapter 5, verses 11 through 14. Other women in 2 Timothy chapter 3 were weighed down by sin. And so there's a lot of struggles going on in the church in Ephesus. There's a lot of issues. And so in light of that, Paul gives Timothy some teaching on how to have a proper atmosphere in worship. What should worship look like? I mean, if we've got all of this stuff going on in our personal lives and even in our corporate life in church, then we need to have a worshipful or a proper atmosphere in worship. How do we do that? And so that's really what he talks about. And the first thing he talks about is holiness. Holiness in worship. This is chapter 2, beginning in verse 8. It won't be on the screen, so read it with me if you would. 1 Timothy chapter 2, starting in verse 8. We're talking about holiness in worship. 1 Timothy 2, beginning in verse 8. I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands in prayer without anger or disputing. I also want women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, not with braided hair, gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. So here's a sense of what it looks like for holiness in worship. So men have a certain responsibility, verse 8. Men carry a certain responsibility for making worship holy. Now, back in chapter 2, Paul's already told Timothy he wants believers everywhere to pray all kinds of prayers, including prayers that everyone will be saved. That's chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. And so now Paul's thoughts evidently turn to what does that look like, praying in the corporate setting, praying in the worship assembly. So, and he wants men to pray all kinds of prayers in all kinds of situations and pray that everyone's saved. But what does that look like in the worship setting? What does it look like in the corporate setting? And one of the things he says is that men can make worship holy by lifting up holy hands in prayer. That's not a command to pray lifting up hands. The idea here is that what he's doing here is taking what the normal posture was for praying in the public setting and saying you need to do it right. So the normal posture in a public setting, in corporate worship in the first century, was the man would be standing up, looking up, holding his hands up and praying. That was considered, you know, for us the normal posture is, you know, maybe not this, but, you know, we bow our heads, we put our heads down. It was just as common in those days to stand up, look up, put your hands up. And so what Paul's saying to Timothy, if you've got guys in the congregation that are going to be praying in corporate setting, they need to be praying, if they're going to show their hands to God, those need to be hands that have been used for God's purposes, not for ungodly purpose, not for immoral. So don't go out and be worldly during the week. Don't use these hands for worldly things during the week and then come show them to God like you're giving them to him to serve. Does that make sense? So you need to lift up hands that have been serving God all week long if you're going to try to lift up hands before God on Sunday. That's what he's really saying. Now, I don't know about you. I don't have any problem if somebody wants to lift their hands in worship. I don't have any problem with that. That doesn't take anything away from my worship. I don't know that I've been compelled to do that, and maybe just the setting I grew up in. But my thought is, sometimes for me, if I'm sitting there and we're singing, I kind of do this a little bit. I don't know if I do it I'm not sure I keep time. but it keeps my knees from locking and me falling over, you know, flat on my face. So if I figure if this helps me kind of get connected and stay in worship, and people behind me can put up with that, then maybe somebody can deal with that, even if they're not used to it. This is not a command. If you're going to pray, lift up holy hands. But it's a command. If you're going to lift up holy hands, if you're going to lift up hands, make sure they're holy. Does that work? Does that make sense? All right. So one way that men can make the worship holy is when they pray, to make sure that their life throughout the week is in harmony with the words and the posture they take up on Sunday. That's kind of loaded now. It's a whole lot more than just lifting up hands. You've heard people talk about, we're a loving congregation until church lets out, and then don't dare getting caught in front of a car in the parking lot because people are running you over getting to the restaurant early. The idea is that we need to be people who are consistently holy, not just putting on your Sunday best and putting on your best words and your best attitude and coming to church and putting on a face and putting on a show. It's what do you do the rest of the week? And so there's the call. One way to make worship holy is to live holy. And what he uses to describe that is lifting up holy hands in prayer. Men can also make worship holy by avoiding anger and disputing. I think that's kind of interesting that he tells us guys to do that. I'm not one that's prone to anger and disputing, but Jan sure is. And that's a lie. That's a lie. I'm sorry. Yeah, it is. It's not a lie. Not only tonight, Randy, but it's a lie almost all the time. Because if there's anybody in this family that's going to be angered and disputing, it's not going to be Jan. We talked about that at dinner tonight. Do you suppose, gentlemen, that maybe Paul was inspired by the Holy Spirit to point that to you and me, because maybe we tend to be people who let our anger get the better of us? Maybe we enjoy a good argument every now and then? Or is it just me? You kind of think Paul was that way? Paul was a guy who didn't back away from a fight, did he? Yeah. There's an entire mob that wants to kill him. And he goes, this is a great time for a sermon. Let's talk about God. Let's talk about Jesus, which is kind of interesting because we're coming up on chapter 7 in natural evangelism. And one of the things that in chapter 7 I'm looking for, is it chapter 7 or 8, whatever next Sunday week is, and he was talking, he uses Acts 22 with Paul about to get killed, and he uses that for his discussion on evangelism. And it's always just floored me. There's a riot in Ephesus and people want to kill him. He goes, oh, there's a crowd. Can I talk to him? There's a folks in the Romans have to come to the temple grounds to save Paul from the people who want to tear him to pieces. And he goes, well, while we're here, you got a minute for some gospel talk? So Paul's not one to back up from a fight, is he? He's never one to back up from a fight. And I think maybe there's some, at least whether or not we want to take ownership of that, or whether or not anybody else wants to take ownership of that with me here tonight, evidently there were some in the church in Ephesus, some men who were like Paul, and in that they never wanted to back down from a fight, maybe even want to start one. So do everything with avoiding anger and disputing. Now, if you go to chapter 6 and verses 3 through 5, there were some false teachers in Ephesus who were evidently fond of controversies and quarrels. And that resulted in constant friction in the church. 1 Timothy 6, let's see if my notes are good. Yeah, 1 Timothy 6, beginning in verse 3. If anyone loves false doctrine, if anyone teaches false doctrines and does not agree to the sound doctrine of our Lord Jesus Christ and to godly teaching, he's conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words that result in envy, strife, malicious talk, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of corrupt mind who have been robbed of the truth and who think that godliness is a means of financial gain. So there's some folks in the church in Ephesus who don't mind causing a ruckus and who enjoy a good argument now and then. Jan's youngest sister, Missy, is turned kind of like me. And so the best way we can drive Jan crazy is when we get together for family stuff, is just pick a subject. I don't care what it is. You pick a subject, you pick which side you want to be on, you pick what side I'm on, and we'll just argue about it. We'll just have, and we did that till 2 a.m. one time, just having a ball, and Jan was just ready to pull her hair out. She does not like that. So men have a responsibility in worship to lift up holy hands in prayer, hands that reflect a holy lifestyle, and to avoid anger and disputing, to be look for harmony and unity in the church. Women, verses 9 through 10, also bear responsibility for making worship holy. Verse 9, women dress, the way a woman dresses can affect the atmosphere in worship. Chapter 2, verse 9, this is the old NIV, I also want women to dress modestly, with decency and propriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or expensive clothes. So you tell me, is this an admonition against jewelry and hairdos and nice clothes? Is he forbidding braided hair? Is he forbidding jewelry? Is he saying this is not appropriate? Is it still relevant in the church today? Or is there something else that he's trying to get across? And no, I'm not trying to start an argument.
It is if that's your primary manner of drawing attention to yourself.
So what do you do to draw attention to yourself? What is your calling card? Is that kind of what you're saying? Yeah. So if all you've got is fancy clothes and fancy hairdo, and there's nothing behind that. And what was it, Wednesday night, we were talking about picking a mate and being careful in picking a mate. And Devin was over here, and he was talking about character. Well, that's exactly what I think what Paul's writing to Timothy about. Women are called to be people with character. But Jan and I had this conversation, I don't remember how many years ago, but her question was, you know, does that still apply today? Does that apply? Do we take that literally? Modesty and decency, okay, propriety, but is it wrong to wear braided hair or gold or pearls or expensive clothes? I'm sorry?
Not in today's world.
Not in today's world, okay. It's normal. It's not the unusual. Okay, so. So, and her question to me was well, and my answer was not in today's world. And she goes, well, doesn't say that here. And I'm sorry?
What's costly clothes?
Yeah, to one to another. Yeah, and now to be fair, this is in a culture when clothes were so valuable, they traded them like currency. Now, I don't know that we have that today. If you have a garage sale and your clothes, you know, if you have a garage sale, you'd be lucky to get $2 for your clothes, right? So we don't have that same, they don't have to hold the same values they did before. But, okay, good point. Robert?
I was going to say, like, it's really in contrast to verse 10, like, but.
Yeah.
So, like, it depends what is, you know, proper for when you're confessing God. So, like,
yeah. So they're dressing toward the to try to identify with the upper echelon, with the power brokers, with the power families and those kind of folks. Okay, anybody else?
Something that would draw attention to themselves.
Yeah, I think that's all kind of all together. If someone, and this, I think this is true for men as well. By the way, I think that anger and disputing could apply to women. And maybe if that applies to you, then you may need to take that personally. But the overdressing could apply to men too, can it? I mean, we can be showy. The question is, who or what should be the center of attention in the worship assembly? God, right? We're come to worship God. And so if I or you dress or act in a way that tries to make us the center of attention, if we try to become the center of attention, and women can do that through wonderful, pretty clothes, and well, guys can too, and some of us can do fancy hairdos, and some of us do jewelry and all that. I mean, we can try to become the center of attention, and that's drawing it away from where a proper worship, holiness and worship, has got it at its center. Now, I don't know. I remember hearing a judge years and years and years ago. He was sitting on a case on pornography, and he says, I don't know how to define it, but I know when I see it. And that's kind of like modesty. I mean, my measure of modesty and your measure of modesty might be somewhat different. So I think Harry brings up a great point. Our measure of modesty today versus the measure of modesty they had when this was first written are light years apart from each other. So that seems to be something that kind of comes and goes with culture, and it'll be different in an upper income community than in a lower income community. It'll be different in Ukraine than it is in Cambodia than it is here. And so it's kind of like I've heard people read this and want to set up a dress code for the church. You know, so when you were in school, ladies, they had, back when they wore skirts, it had to be what? I think when my sister was there, it had to be kind of where the fingertips hit, and then it was so many inches above the knees or something. Well, do you think God is asking Paul to write a dress code for the church in Ephesus? Yeah, I don't think so either. I think what he's doing is calling everyone to come to worship with a clear conscience that we're trying to make God the focal point. And me, I'm going to check my anger and my love for debate at the door, because I don't want to take the focus away from God while I'm having a great debate with somebody. And you're going to take and dress in a way that's fitting and appropriate for you and your lifestyle and your income level and your taste, but that doesn't try to make you the center of attention and take it away from God, who is supposed to be the center of attention. Does that deal with? Right.
What you're supposed to show up in.
Right. Now, and Kay, when I was growing up, I had Sunday clothes that I only got to wear on Sunday. Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, I had Sunday clothes that you only wore on Sunday. Yeah.
You knew you were supposed to dress. It didn't have to be fancy, but it
right.
was plain and neat.
It was usually, in my house, it was the best thing in your closet. Because my mother used to sew suits for me. She loved to sew. She'd make suits for me. I was so cute. Little baby blue suit with the little shorts and the little jacket and the little tie and the little hat. I was a darling. No wonder Jan fell for me. But that was the best thing in my closet. The best thing in my closet. And so then I had school clothes that were kind of a step down from that. Then I had play clothes that was what was left over from these two and hand me down from somebody else, right?
I bet you outgrew.
Yeah.
And you're still wearing.
I'm sorry?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. My mother used to say she was going to put fringe on the bottom because I kept getting taller and my pants would be short. Yeah.
But Sunday clothes, you were supposed to show respect by wearing your best outfit.
Right.
Which was your Sunday outfit.
And see, I used to preach with you're singing to the choir here. I used to preach with coat and tie because I was raised when you go to church, you give God your best. And heaven help you show up front without a coat and a tie on. And that was taboo. Now, okay, so thoughts on that?
No, but we remember too also that women could only wear dresses to church, and it wasn't until.
Yeah, I can't wear slacks to church. Yeah. So, now I tell you what, so Kay, you notice I don't wear ties and don't wear suits very often. I'm preaching for 25 years, and for probably 10 years of that, 15 years, I was operating under give God your best, and give God your best was the best in your closet. And then the church secretary there had a brother who lived in New Mexico, Now, Hobbs, New Mexico, and he and I got to know each other from hospital visits because they had a big family and they had a lot of illness in their family. And so I got to know her brother from hospital visits. And he wasn't going to church. He kind of walked away from his faith, but he and I had kind of struck up a friendship, just kind of getting to know each other. And one day he wanted to come visit his sister in Gainesville, Texas, and he says, I want to go hear Brother David preach, but I don't have a suit. And that's the first time I thought, well, okay, is giving God... Now, you're welcome to just disagree with me. This is my logic, and sometimes my logic lacks logic. So, but this is my logic, and that is, if I'm dressing in a way that makes somebody feel like they're not good enough or can't dress well enough to come worship, then maybe giving God my best isn't the fanciest thing I have in the closet. And so I was talking with one of the elders here, and they said, well, I said, I don't know. I said, because if I wear a coat and tie, there's some people who make a point going, hey, you look good today. And then if I dress down, there's somebody else go, hey, I like it better when you dress down. And people pay too much attention to what the preacher wears. But I said, I'm not sure what to do. And he said, well, if you wear jeans for the folks like you to dress down and a sport coat for the ones like you to dress up, that's kind of the best. So that's kind of where I'm trying to hit the middle. So I kind of decided, and it was hard for me because I was raised to give God your best. That meant the best thing you had in your closet. But I kind of felt like if I'm setting a standard that somebody who wants to come worship feels like they can't live up to, then maybe that's not my best. So now, I'm not asking you to agree with that. I'm just saying that's been my kind of journey here on why I don't wear coats and ties anymore. But I grew up with that, and I remember early on, you give God your best. Okay. Thank you, Kay. Very great comment. Appreciate that. What else? All things to all people, in hopes of winning some. Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know that quite says you dress down to accommodate those who don't have the best clothes.
Yeah, and I wrote a series of articles for the Bulletin when I made that switch in the congregation down in Texas. And there were some that were like, right on, and some like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. So I just, yeah. But I guess if you can't come alongside me on any of that, maybe we can come together on at least the fact that we need to be making clothing choices based on what we think honors God and puts Him at the center of attention. And if we can't come anywhere else, maybe we can. And if you have a different opinion about how you should dress to honor God and put Him in the center of attention, then I want to honor that for you, and hopefully it's a two-way street. Larry?
Well, you think about it in our lives, if we've got something special to go to, not in the church.
Right.
Anywhere special to go to, we might put a suit and a tie.
Yeah, funeral? Or wedding?
Funeral or anything.
Yeah. Okay.
And I didn't have a suit with me, but I did have a sport coat, and I was hopeful that would be...
Hope a sport coat was good enough to meet the president?
Yeah.
Who's going to be wearing a coat and tie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't say anything, so I guess it was all
right. He didn't kick you out? Another interesting point... Our generation, and I think the word respect was mentioned in that comment, our generation tends to place moral value on clothes, so that if someone were to dress below what we believe is a proper standard, that would be seen as disrespectful. And what's interesting, I've had a lot of conversation with folks in their 30s and younger, and right or wrong, and this is a small little snippet of that age group. I have certainly not done a big broad survey, but I've talked to some people in that age group to try to get a sense of how they, because the younger ones always go, hey, You sure look squirrely in that coat and tie. You know, I like you better. You know, and then folks my age go, you know, coat and tie, keep doing that. So I was trying to get a feel for why they were doing that. And what's interesting to me, and I don't pretend to understand it, I just have to take it at face value that they're being honest with me. What I've been told is they don't place the same moral value, respect on clothes that we do. In fact, one guy I talked to, he said, you know, if I dress differently to come to church than I do the rest, and he worked for AT&T, the lineman for AT&T, and he said, if I dress differently coming to church than I do the rest of the week, said, that makes me a hypocrite. Now, I'm not asking you to agree with him. I'm just thinking, if I'm trying to get in his head and understand where his head's at, he has a 180 view that, from me, which is not unusual. I mean, a lot of 30-year-olds have a 180 view from me on stuff. I mean, so that's not unusual. But that kind of clued me into how varied the opinions are on clothes and propriety and what's good and what's bad and what's right and what's wrong. His opinion is it would be bad for him to put on his Sunday best because it would be hypocritical because he's not that way the rest of the week. I was raised, it'd be bad for you to wear the same clothes you wore all week long because you're not putting your Sunday best on. And God's calling us to worship together and love each other and be in harmony with each other and encouraging one of the two things we're supposed to do when we come here is worship God and edify one another. And I got to edify that guy that's 180 from me, and he's supposed to be edifying me. And so that's God's funny sense of humor, putting all of us weird people together and expecting us to work together in harmony. Daniel? And, yeah.
Even to the extent we would bring tithes and shirts and stuff to put in the spots at church for those who didn't.
So you donate tithes so somebody didn't have a tie could put on a tie.
Right. And so it came across as, you know, that's the expectation. When you come here with a shirt and tie on.
Right.
And so forth. Even to the extent, and one day went to a funeral with family. And one of the family members chose not to go to the funeral. And so, you know, we said, why are you not going to the funeral? It's your family member, da, da, da. And so she said, well, I don't have the kind of clothes you all have, and so I don't want to be up in there, you know, embarrassed.
So a lady didn't feel comfortable going to a family member's funeral because she didn't have nice enough clothes to match everybody else.
Yeah, and so that made me, you know, really think about my dress code.
Right.
I've come to the conclusion that I don't think God is really talking per se about my clothing, but my character and who
yeah.
I am and how I carry myself.
Yeah.
And not trying to bring attention to me.
Yeah. We don't need to make us the center of attention, we need to make God the center of attention, however that works. And what's amazing is someone who dresses down may be distracting to one person, and somebody who dresses up may be distracting to another person. So what does that tell us we need to do? We need to practice grace. We need to practice grace and patience, and we need to be people who are disciplined enough to look past that and put God at the center of our mind and heart. I used to count, but this was back in Texas, I used to count the number of ties and coats on the communion table. And if the tithes and coats outnumbered the non-tithes and coats, that was a good day. And I thought, I don't think that's where God wants my heart and my mind when we're doing communion. I don't think that's where he wants my heart. So that required a certain amount of discipline to get over that because that was how I was raised. And I am not suggesting that you need to come along to my way of thinking because I said sometimes my logic lacks logic, but at least we need to give each other the benefit of the doubt that we're making choices based on our heart and our love of God and our love for each other that we're trying to set a proper atmosphere for worship. And I think if we can give each other that kind of grace, then we can have room for a lot of differences of opinion, but still come together to try to worship God. So, yeah, character. Let's do this. Verse 10, a woman's beauty comes from her character, not from her wealth, not from her beauty. So a woman who professes to worship God should adorn themselves with good deeds and or good works, some translations say. And that took me to 1 Peter. This is verse 10. But a woman shouldn't dress with fancy clothes and try to show out, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. That took me to 1 Peter chapter 3, where it's a very similar passage, Peter writing to the believer, said, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and wearing gold and jewelry, fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of an inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. So it goes always back to the same thing. God's more interested in what's on the inside, what's on the outside. So our call, first and foremost, is to create a worshipful atmosphere, a holy atmosphere in worship. So that means we need to conduct ourselves in a holy manner. And I think when it goes back to what we talked about with raising up holy hands, I think it all goes back, whether male or female, it all goes back to what are we doing the 6 days before we get here to prepare ourselves for being here. Are we worldly? Are we being in the world, of the world? Are we acting worldly? Are we dressing worldly? Are we speaking worldly? And then we try to come and put on holiness for one day and for 1 hour. Or are we trying to be people who are holy 7 days out of the week, and we're just bringing into our worship assembly the kind of character that we're trying to present all week long? Okay. Thoughts, comments, critiques, criticisms?
You know, as you live your life and you go through the years, we change, you know, in our 20s, 30s, 40s.
Evolve as we get older, yeah.
And on yeah. And sometimes we don't realize how much we have changed.
Right. I look back.
Yeah. I know that it used to be in your work that you had that you, unless it was something where you were a physical worker, but if you were a desk or something.
If you were a white collar worker,
that's right.
You wore a coat and tie.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't wrong then, it's not wrong now.
Not wrong now. My grandfather used to sell Pennzoil back in the day, and from gas station to gas station, where there were such things as gas stations, where they come out there and wipe your windshield and check your oil. Just made it. He would sell Pennzoil, and before they had air conditioning, and so he used to talk about going to a hotel, and he would try to get a hotel with a southeast corner, you know, and you know why? Some of us with some seniority do, because you get the windows opened up and they get a cross breeze in the room because there's no air conditioning. And he would go by the ice factory, I forgot what they call it, but ice house, and get a block of ice and put it in the passenger seat of his car because there was no air conditioning, roll the windows down and hope the air would blow over the ice to come cool him down. But he would never call on a gas station selling Pennzoil without a coat, tie, and hat in Texas all year long. It's a little different today, but that was, so there would have been a different, anyway, we all come from different backgrounds, we come from different ideas, we come from different sensibilities, and what's interesting is when you start talking to people, why do you feel the way you do? Why do you believe the way you do? Why were we raised the way we were? What were we thought? I don't know of very many people who come to church dressed for rebellion. Our job is to give people grace that even though they may not have the same sensibilities we do, that they're trying to accomplish the same goal, to give a holy aspect for worship. All right, anything else? Let's close with a quick prayer. Father, thank you for this time, and thank you for your words, your inspired words that have been recorded so that we can spend time studying. And thank you for this congregation. Thank you for the diversity we have. Thank you for the diverse ages, for the diverse backgrounds, for the diverse history. But thank you for the fact that we all share a love for you and a love for your son and a passion for trying to be the people you call us to be. We thank you for giving us grace as we seek to the center of your will, as we seek to be the people you've called us to be. Father, help us to be mature in our decisions, mature in our actions, mature in our words, and lovingly and graciously in the way that we interact with one another. We thank you for this body of believers. We thank you for the love this congregation has for you and for one another, for the unity we have, for our common purpose and our common faith in your Son and our Savior Jesus Christ. So we give you all praise and glory and celebrate the future we have through faith in your Son. We lift up this prayer in his name. Amen. Thank you, church.